It's time to sit down and relax for the good, the bad, and the sequel Q&A with your host, Doug.
Hey there, Doug here. Lots changed in the last week, so I hope you are practicing social distancing. If you have to go out, if you're working, thank you. We appreciate it. This country needs it. If you're able to, just stay at home, hang out, watch movie sequels. We've covered a lot of them, and there's a lot of good ones that we haven't covered yet. So I just hope myself and this week's guest can help you escape for a little bit. I was lucky enough to interview Robert Hayes. You know him from shows like Angie. He played Brad Benson. He was on that for a while. Of course, as Ted Stryker in Airplane. And on Starman, one of his shows that he loved working on, which was the TV show follow-up to the movie with Jeff Bridges. And also, you know him from Homeward Bound and so many other credits along the way. We talked to him, of course, for Airplane 2, the sequel, which is the next movie that we're going to be reviewing, me and Jamie. And you can watch that on Prime Video if you're an Amazon Prime member, or on Crackle for free. So you can find it. And you're going to love Robert Hayes. He talks about growing up. He talks about how he got started in acting. And it's a really cool way that he got started. It was kind of like by accident. Here's Robert Hayes. This is a pleasure. I love all your work.
Thank you.
This is cool, man. Yeah, so what I like to do with these is really just to find how people got started, why they chose to go into Hollywood, and just talk about some of your premier roles over the years and maybe a few that you enjoyed that maybe people don't talk about as much. So where did you grow up?
Well, my dad was in the Marines. He was in the military. So even though my home, our home base, which they chose as their home, was Newport Beach, you know where that is, Newport Beach and Corona Laguna, that area down there, beach town. So that was where our home base was, but Dad was stationed in Washington, D.C. at the Naval Institute, Naval Department. And so I was born at the Naval Hospital. The Marines are in the Department of the Navy. So,
oh, nice.
You have stuff too. So I was born at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, which is where they would take the presidents and everything. And I think it was, $2.75 was what it cost for me to be born, or $5 or something. So it came pretty cheap.
Yeah, it's a little different than we just had our first baby about a year ago, and it's definitely not $2.75 anymore.
Yeah, it's a little different.
Yeah. So did you stick around Maryland for a while?
I think I was probably maybe 8 months or something when we came back.
Oh, nice.
So we drove back, went up to Canada, and then relatives with us and stuff, and then just drove back. We drove across country. I've been across country by car about 15 times.
Oh, nice. Yeah, me and my wife, we've done it 6, but yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's great. Yeah. And I mean, even the boredom, you get into the boredom of it, and you know, you just have your imagination, which I always had a great imagination.
Yeah.
And so that was, you just let your imagination get carried away, looking at the clouds, looking at the scenery. We sang a lot in the car. My dad played sax and clarinet in high school in his band. And then he had a band with some guys, a trio or a quartet or something. And they'd play around like, you know, quartet type swing music, modern music. And they'd play around, and they had my first cousin once removed, I guess it would be, told me that when he was about 10 or 15 years younger than Dad. So he was a little kid, but he saw in front of the theater, there in Bakersfield, they had one of those sandwich boards out there. And on the sandwich board, it said "Swing and Sway with Johnny Hayes and the Happy Days."
Wow. So
that was pretty cool. And then years later, that same cousin sent me a picture of the marquee up there, and it said Airplane, and then underneath it said Robert Hayes and Julie Haggerty.
Wow. And that's pretty cool.
So I had all of that. Yeah, I had all those really cool pictures, and they kind of don't have those anymore, but I had them for a while. I got them in my memory.
Yeah, no, definitely. So from him playing and being in a band, is that something that made you think about doing something bigger? Like, when was like that aha moment for you?
Well, no, I mean, I my mom's uncle, my great uncle Hal, worked at Universal Studios for about 30 years.
Oh, wow.
In the publicity department. So he'd get pictures of Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh and Cary Grant and, you know, all these amazing actors and actresses, and he'd have them sign a picture to Bobby. So I had all those pictures that I still had just up until a year ago. I still had all those things. I don't know if I ever really thought about doing that. I mean, I was an Indian in Pocahontas and John Smith in the second grade, but that's the only thing I ever did.
Really? That was the only thing you ever did, like, play-wise in school?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. I was never in any of that. Never got into it. Never was interested. But when I transferred, we were back in Nebraska. To Newport Harbor High School in Newport Beach, 8th grade and junior high, and the 9th, 10th, and 11th. And my class ring was all ready for the next year, my senior year. And that summer, Dad comes home and says, "We're moving." So we went to Omaha, just outside Omaha, to Bellevue, Nebraska. And I thought, Jesus, I'm a water baby, you know. And
yeah.
Go surfing, we're out surfing. And all of a sudden, I'm as far as you can get from the ocean, you know, 1,500 miles either way from the ocean. So that was a real bummer. But then we got there. On a Tuesday, and waiting in the guest quarters is like a motel on the base until you get your quarters assigned to you, your living quarters. And got there on a Tuesday. Saturday, we had a horse. We still didn't have a place to live. So I just went out and I kind of, you know, bed the horse and brush him down. And then I'd start riding him, and I tried to ride him bareback, and I'd fall off, and he'd look around at me like an idiot. And he basically, Paint was his name, and he taught me how to ride, because every time I'd fall off, he'd stare at me and then wait for me to get back up, and then we'd go again. And I became a good rider, actually, but didn't know anybody, so I had my horse, and that was it. But I'd ride along the Missouri River and go to a little place. Once I started meeting people there, and they had horses, and we'd all ride down to Henny Penny. It was a little, sort of like a Dairy Queen kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And we'd ride into that. And I was probably the oldest of all the kids, you know, for the most part. And then a couple of kids close to my age. But we'd ride out there. I'd stand and hold the horses while they all went in and got their snow cones or burgers and, you know, whatever. And then one of them finally would take pity on me and come out and pull the horses while I go in and get something. And by then everyone's ready to go, so I got to scarf it down. And, yeah. But it was great. I mean, it absolutely, Nebraska turned out to be an absolute jewel in my life. The time there was just great. And the people were great. The country is great. That part of the country is great. The horses and the, I mean, everything was just, it was really terrific. Met some of my great buddies that I'm still friends with. And so, yeah. And then when I moved back, Dad was transferred over to Vietnam, and I was at home with my mom. By that time, I was going to Omaha University, which is now part of the University of Nebraska.
Oh, okay.
But it was Omaha University then, and I went there for about a year and a half, and then came back. And when I came back, I was a transfer student, so all the classes were pretty much taken. So I got the dregs, you know, just whatever was left. And there was a track and field course, which was a PE class. And it winds up that I didn't have to take it because I already had enough PE. So I escaped that because I'm lazy as the dickens. So that was, you know, it would have been good for me to do it. But, you know, look back in hindsight. But there was that, and there was beginning acting. And I thought, you know what? This is a great excuse to take it because
that's cool.
because I have no choice.
Yeah.
Because that's all that's available. And I got into it, and I just took to it like a fish to water. I loved it. And I was going to school 14, sometimes 18 hours a day, just all day classes. And then you'd do the shows at night. And I was running lights and the only one up in the light booth. So I'd have set the presets, set up the lights with the fader. And then I'd have the preset for the next light setting. And then I'd have the spotlight. I'd be running with my hands, changing the gels and the zoom on the spot. And we didn't have headsets. They'd hooked up an old telephone they got. So I had that in the crook of my neck, holding the telephone there, talking with the AD. And then I'd lean over with my left foot and hook my toe around the fader. And I'd fade in the scene with my foot while I'm running the spots with my hands and then talking with the phone in the crook of my neck. And so it was really pretty crazy, but it was so much fun.
Crazy, you're in California and you take the acting classes in Omaha, Nebraska. So that's pretty neat.
Well, the acting classes were in California.
Oh, that was in California still. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought that was still at University of Omaha.
No, when I left there, I came back to San Diego because Dad was transferred. I guess I forgot that little part. He was transferred to Vietnam and I stayed home. We were down in El Cajon, just outside San Diego.
Oh, nice.
And in Grossmont College in El Cajon. And I transferred into there, but being a transfer student, there was nothing left except beginning acting, basically. Yeah. So there was a meteorological class, and I thought, okay, well, I'll take it just so I could take it and get a class. And the teacher was just the snottiest pile of shit, and he used to, because I wasn't wanting to be a weatherman. He felt I was wasting someone's time, you know, everyone's time by being there. And he would not miss a chance to try to humiliate me and make fun of me in the class. And I finally said, I really don't need this asshole in my life. So I left, which he made him very happy, I'm sure. Made me happy too. But so I got out of that. So it was just the acting. And then I crashed all the other courses, the set design, lighting design, makeup. How to do stage makeup and the history of the theater and, you know, all the acting classes, everything. I just couldn't get enough of it. I just loved it.
That's awesome. Yeah. When was your next step into maybe like auditioning? Cause just from reading about you, I wouldn't have known you did all the behind the scenes stuff even before, you know, you were on
stage. Well, that's in school. And yeah. Then you're at the same time and then you start auditioning and pretty soon I was getting, I don't know, a kind of a reputation, I guess, that if I was kind of saying, yeah, that's the role I'm going to audition for, that's the one I want to get, the teachers were really kind of paying attention because they thought I was talented enough. They liked what I was doing. And so I'd almost get, the one I was pointing at.
Oh, wow.
So I did that. And then I went to, I think I was still at Grossmont. I auditioned, my God, right about now, 50 years ago, wow, with my buddy of mine who became my buddy. We all met on this. It was our first show at the Old Globe. And Don Sparks, who's living back east now, and Jennifer Henn, who's living out here, and she's married. Down in Orange County somewhere maybe, but it was our first show and it was a comedy. What do they call them? I forget what they call them. But it was like a class thing. I was rich. And then it was called Halfway Up the Tree. And I had a very stodgy, rich father, very, very wealthy. And it was in a British kind of setting. And I was very rich. But then I kind of go off and I kind of get all hippied out and with a beard, long hair. And then I come back and get all cleaned up. And then he's got the beard and long hair and he's climbed up the tree. So it's one of those things, you know, where switch around. And he was just wonderful. He was a community actor. He was like, a businessman that was really successful and really, really but such a wonderful guy. And he was a wonderful actor. And that's just, you know, there are people that are in business, but they always enjoyed the arts. And that's the way they get their jollies, is getting to do stuff like that in community theater. And in community theater, you know, there are a lot of people that are, typical high school community theater kind of level quality of acting. But then you've got some people in community theater that are really, really good. They just didn't want to go through that living in your bus, living on a sack of rice kind of existence. And you wanted a little more stability in their lives. So they got real jobs, you know, but they still loved the theater. So there's a bunch of them around. There are a bunch up in Ojai. Girlfriend of mine is up there in Ojai, and she runs a theater up there, and she teaches it in school up there, but she also runs a theater, and they do some really, really fine productions up there. So anyway, that's what that was. That was that. And then I went to San Diego State for just a little bit of time, but kind of butted heads with the people there a little. If you had to be an usher before you could get audition for any shows. And one friend of mine had to be an usher for this one production. And he got cast at the Old Globe Theater. And one night, he had to be gone. And he got someone to replace him. And they told him, if you're not there, you don't do your job as an usher, we're flunking you. And I mean, they were just asses.
Jeez.
And so I thought, you know, who needs this crap and who needs these idiots? So I just parted ways with them. And I was living in my bus from when my dad came back from Vietnam. I had traded in my first car and a Chevy, little old Chevy. And I got a 66 Volkswagen bus and I put a bunk in it and I lived in it in and
That's
out of
awesome.
It. I still have it 52 years later and I still have it.
Oh really? Does it run?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. This February, it'll be 52 years. But, so I just moved into my bus when he came back and I lived in and out of it for 2 years and then finally wound up, with, my buddy Don, got an apartment and then Dave Leisure, a buddy of mine from Grossmont. We had done plays and stuff there together. And then he moved in. So we were over near the Balboa Park, near the theater. And that was just great. It was just really, really neat. Great, great times.
Not bad.
Yeah. So I was at the Globe for 5 or 6 years. I was building sets and changing sets and at the same time doing the shows, and it was really, really, really fun. Really fun. But I always loved construction. I always loved building things. So I did that with my dad. We built a home that they lived in, made up in Fallbrook when he came back from Vietnam. When he was in Vietnam, he read an article and it said on Popular Mechanics or something, the cover story, it said, build your own home for 1/3 the cost. And like he would always say, he said, it's my Scots blood. So he wrote back to mom, said, honey, find some land. And so we got 5 acres near Escondido, and when he got back, things had really grown. The town had grown, and it was starting to encroach on that land, and said, let's find some other land. So found a guy to design adobe homes, he and his brothers, the Weir brothers, and Larry Weir designed mom and dad's home, and they would do it anywhere from completely building it themselves for you, all the way down to they design it and then you completely build it yourself and anywhere in between, you know, and had him come in once in a while and give a little advice here and there. But they were planning on going their own separate ways and dissolving their business together. So he told dad, and dad put a bid, told him about what their equipment would be, and dad put a bid on it and got it. And so we had a skip loader, little tractor, and then we had cement mixer and the forms for making your bricks and all the tools and the transit and lots of trowels and hammers and nails and I mean, all of the stuff. And we just started. The first thing I did was driving the tractor. I'd scoop up dirt so I could learn how to drive all the controls. And then I started scooping it up and we had perfect dirt for making adobe. And so I scooped up, I made about a 8 or 10 foot tall pile of dirt. And then we just take a half a scoop, pour it in the cement mixer, and then throw in a 5-gallon bucket of emulsified asphalt and a 5-gallon bucket of water, stir it all up and then dump it back into the tractor and go over and dump it in the farms and push it around, screed it off and go to the next one. And we made over 16,000 bricks.
Damn.
And that house is, man, it is beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. We unfortunately had to sell it some years back after the folks passed away, but it's really something. But anyway, so I've always loved building things with my dad, especially. And so when it came to the sets, I already knew how to build. So whatever they wanted, I could hammer it together. And I even wound up doing that on some films. I did that on a film that Charlie Martin Smith directed with Peter Weller and me. And Charlie, we got Charlie to be in the film too. And we were in Malaysia. And they were having trouble with the psych that they had set up in a hangar behind the plane so they could film us in the plane like we're flying. And they couldn't get where the seams came together, the four flats that they put together, but they couldn't blend the paint properly. And they just could not get it. You could see the seams. It was really obvious. And so finally I said, I got to get out of here. I got to get back to the States because my first baby boy, my son, he was going to be born, and I didn't want to miss it. So I said, come on. So finally I said, give me that. And I went over there and I started fiddling with it. I painted it, got up on the ladder and painted all over it. I bit back and I blend this and blend that. Get down. We all looked at it and said, he did it. And so, okay, let's shoot. So I've always been kind of, you know, I mean, here you can't do that. You'll get in trouble with unions, but over there we could do it.
Yeah.
But,
So when it comes to like IMDb, it's like never right. And I know you said you were working at that theater for 5-6 years. So in 75, they have your first like credits, Marcus Welby, MD, and Rockford Files.
That's the year I moved up to LA.
Oh, okay.
I had done a thing in San Diego. My very first credit was, it just went out of my mind. They shot it up here. Later, but they shot it in San Diego to begin with. Harry O. It was called Harry O. And Harry-O. And it was kind of a Rockford Files kind of a thing. But it was with David Jansen. And Eddie Foy, the third, this famous casting director from that famous family of the Foys, Eddie Foy and the Seven Little Foys. And he was the third Eddie Foy. he discovered Sally Field. He cast me in my very first thing, said, call me when you get to LA. And so I got up to LA and I kind of in March of 75, and I kind of felt a little embarrassed. I was never a pushy guy, which you got to be in this business, I guess. But I finally called him and he said, when'd you get here? And I said, oh, man, I'm about 2 years. So why didn't you call me? Hey, can you be at so-and-so tomorrow? And I said, yeah. And so he started casting me in these things called Lamp Unto My Feet and other, you know, religious shows. They were like little half-hour religious soap opera kind of shows, little dramas. And they were on Sunday mornings. And they were great shows for us actors to just have things to be able to work at. And A. Martinez was in it. Pepe Serna was in one. I remember it was just really fun. And so I did that. I did a few of those. I don't know, 3 or 4 of those, seems like. And then he said, you got an agent? And I said, no. I had my acting coach, Sal Dano, who would come to San Diego once a week on Thursday nights. And then when I came up here, I just kept going to his classes up here, where his main studio was. He was great. And so Eddie said, I got a buddy of mine who's just left an agency and he's going on his own. So I called him up, Arnie Soloway. I called him up and I went over. He said, yeah, you got a good look and good height. Good. Yeah. Well, let me know if you want to do it. So I said, all right, I'll let you know. So I go back to the acting class that night and they're saying, so what? Hey, I got an interview. And I go, what are you doing, Bob? I said, well, some guy wants to be my agent. You got an agent? I said, well, I don't know. I'm thinking about it. Oh, you got to take it. You got to do it. So I thought, well, maybe so. Maybe nobody else will want me. So I called him up and said, yeah, okay. I didn't realize it was in his apartment. He'd just broken off from the Susan Smith agency, I think it was. And he was in his apartment. And I think I was his first client, or I was the first new client that he had signed. He may have taken one or two from the other agency, but I was the first new one that he signed. But it was illegal to be an agent without having an office. You had to have an office. Managers could do it out of their home, but agents had to have offices. And so it was kind of an illegal setup. But I didn't realize that at the time. But the great thing about Arnie was he'd have pictures of his clients, and he'd go around. This is the way they used to do it. Nowadays, it's all online and it's all internet shit and everything, you know. But then your agent would go around and he would take a stack of pictures and say, yeah, what about this guy for that role? And they go, yeah, I don't know. And this girl here, what about for that? And they'd say, yeah, I don't know. And he'd say, well, yeah, but she does this. And he would really talk you up. But he used to take me with him. So I would sit in his big old, whatever it was, like a 75 Caddy convertible or whatever. And he was, you know, in the sun all the time, just tan, like a brown bean. And he'd have that coat on with the silk shirt unbuttoned down almost to his belly button with gold chains. And I remember one time going up to this real sleazy kind of agent kind of guy. It was a role. And I thought, God, man, this is just not me. This isn't right. And he says, hey, just do me. I don't even think I went on it. And if I did, it was just like, they could tell this isn't right. And so I never did that role. But him taking me, they could see me live. It wasn't just a headshot. He'd leave the headshot of me with him. But he said, I want you to meet my new young guy here. And I'd say, hey, how you doing? And so they got to see me, and they'd see an animated person instead of just a headshot. And I started getting one line, two line, three line, Marcus Welby, the blue and I, all these things, right? Just have a line or two, and I go back and do another one later. He was sitting around with a couple of other agent buddies of his once, and they were talking about how, yeah, I got a guy. He did 5 shows this year. He's really going good. I got a lot of hopes for him. And the other one said, yeah, I got a guy. He's done about 3. And, you know, but I expect to get a couple of more. How about you, Arn? And he says, oh, I got this young kid. He did over 24 shows in a year and a half. And they said, what? I was working like I was putting fires out, and that was doing one and then 2 lines and then later 4 lines, working up until pretty soon I was doing guest star shots. And then I was doing guest stars in movies of the week and then starring in an ensemble young kids kind of movie of the week called Delta County USA. And then, doing some movies where I was starring in them in Park City, Utah, the Sun Classics movies over there. And while I was there, they had me do a screen test while I had a cowboy outfit, and they had me do the screen test for Angie. And so I did that, and they sent it back, and I got that. And that was my first TV series. And then while I was doing Angie, that was really good. Gosh, someone's knocking at the door. Can you hold on a second?
Oh, yeah, no problem.
I want to get rid of these. Hold on.
So we were talking about Angie and then, like, when you landed that role. So you said you screen tested for it. Was it big that you did? Because you were on a Laverne and Shirley a few years before.
Well, I was on Laverne and Shirley. I was on the episode that introduced the character of Angie, who was the nemesis of Laverne, who I was dating her in the show, in that episode. I was a bus driver, and I took her on a date in the bus with my bus uniform and my little coin changer on my belt. And we said, we got to get a girl for Shirley. So I got my buddy Moose, and he was this huge, big, Mike McManus played him. He was very funny, and he's a funny writer and a comedian and an actor and everything. But, we go to the pool hall, and I grab my belt and, you know, push those little levers. You get the change out. Ka-ching, ka-ching.
Yeah.
Here, you want a soda? You want a soda? Ka-ching. And so then this biker gang comes in with their biker malls, and we wind up being dragged out in the alleyway. And, of course, I'm probably going to have the crap beat out of me. But meanwhile, the whole scene is them, you know, the girls in there. And it was Angie, who was Carol Ida White. And she said, yeah, I'm going to rip that L off your sweater. And Laverne says, you touch my L, your teeth go to Peoria. So that was that whole big scene. And that was, it introduced Angie. And then years later, it's gone through evolutions. And now she had married a dentist, I think, in years later on Laverne and Shirley. But in the spinoff, she was a poor Italian girl. And now Donna Pescal, who looks a lot different than Carolina White, a lot shorter. And, you know, she was that cute little thing. She was in Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
And so she was a waitress in just a poor Italian family. And then she meets me, Brad, and I'm a pediatrician. They changed him from a dentist to a pediatrician. And unbeknownst to her, I'm come from a family that is just multi-billionaires, like big multinational corporations, all that stuff. So it is like, you know, the biggest money that you can think of.
Yeah.
You never saw how much it was, but it was, you know, it's just the rich sister with her daughter. And it's like, oh, I'm so exhausted. I've been shopping all day, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I didn't want to go into that part of the business or be that way in the family. I wanted to do something. So I became a doctor and I'm a pediatrician. I got my own little practice. And, you know, they're wondering, when are you ever going to come back to the fold and be of some use, you know? And meanwhile, I fall in love with this little poor girl. So it's the rich guy and the poor girl. And then as we're shooting that, I get airplane. And then it overlaps by 2 weeks when we come back from the summer break. You know, between the first season was a mid-season. It was mid-season replacement. So we did have two seasons. It's just the first one wasn't a complete one, but we did have two. But, and that was, to me, it was just great. It was so much fun. And we had the guys from Cheers, a bunch of the guys from Cheers. We had them as writers and as, like, you know, guys that our producers, Bob, shoot, I can't even think of his name. This is terrible. You're asking these questions. I should know every single thing.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. but almost had it. He was tall and lanky. He was about 6'3", 6'2", and it kind of didn't look like Jimmy Stewart, but there was this quality of like a lanky Jimmy Stewart, Midwesterner.
Yeah.
And he had such a kind of a funny and sometimes occasionally twisted, but so funny sense of humor. And he was just so great. But when he came out to New York, he came out because he was playing sax, I think. And he used to wander around on the streets in New York, and you see those newsstands. They're all kind of grungy, and you go in, and it's, you got all the stuff here, but then you go right in the back shelves, and it's got all the sleazy, you know, horrible magazines. And so here's this real innocent-looking guy, and he'd walk up to the guy with the newsstand, and he'd say, excuse me, do you have the Christian Science Monitor? And the guy would start to look embarrassed because it's such a sleazy joint. And he'd say, no, I'm sorry, we don't carry that. And he says, oh, okay, well, I'll take a copy of Screw magazine then. And the guy would just, you know, but he would do it just for the effect, just to get the guy.
That's great.
But anyway, he was fantastic. The first season was my favorite. It was fresh and it was new. In the second season, we had a whole bunch of people that were really wonderful, really liked them a lot, but it was a different thing. And it was more kind of focused more on Angie, on the girls. It was a bunch of women that came into it. So the women are going to want to focus on women.
Yeah.
You know, so they had to focus on me too, but you know, somewhat, but It was really fun. And Gary Marshall was the, created it because he created all the Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, all those. And this was a spinoff. So he'd be down there a lot. He was so great. Dale McCraven was also on there. And then Miller and Milkus, they were the Miller, Milkus, and later Boyette. They did the Boyette. Bob Boyette came in and did season two. He is now a big time producer on Broadway.
Really?
And has been for years. Yeah. So he's it's really neat. Really kind of fun.
Well, that's awesome. So then at that same time, you said you got Airplane and you're shooting that. So what was that like? Like landing one of the best comedies of all time.
Oh yeah. Gosh. I mean, that was just like winning the lottery.
Yeah.
They'd been all over the place. They looked at people, New York, Chicago and Dallas and Minneapolis, Seattle. I mean, they've been all over the country having people submit stuff and things weren't right. And then they were, the people at Paramount were really helpful with the boys that, they said that they were really, really helpful and they didn't push them too hard. In a couple of cases they did, but they didn't get it. They didn't get that it was, how they wanted serious guys. They wanted a B picture, B movie with B actors, but serious actors.
Yeah.
And they got Bob Stack and Lloyd and Peter. And the one that they really fought him on was Leslie Nielsen. And the guys talk about it. They say that the casting director said, Leslie Nielsen, he's the guy, when you can't find anybody, he's the guy you cast the night before. And of course, he winds up being this legendary character in the, in the whole thing. So they didn't get it. But then when they finally started seeing this stuff, they got it. Mike Eisner was the one that really heard about it. He was having dinner with a woman, I think it was casting another place. He said, well, are you hearing about anything? And she said, I saw something. It was at United Artists, I think. She said, I saw something. I read something I thought was really funny, but UA passed on it. But I thought it was really funny. He said, what is it? Oh, it's these guys from Milwaukee. And they did Kentucky Fried Theater. And it's called Airplane. So he goes back to Katzenberg and he says, and I think Tom Perry was also young VP there at the time. But he goes to them or to Katzenberg and he says, yeah, they've got this thing called Airplane. Go out and get a hold of that. I want to see it, see what, what it is about it. So Katzenberg called him up and said, yeah, we want to take a look at this. And it went in, they met all the things that they wanted. They wanted to direct it. And that was kind of a deal breaker. That's why all the studios were passing on it. I think Warner Brothers finally said, okay, but then it wasn't quite working out. But so then it came down to something like Avco Embassy and Paramount. The Avco Embassy, which was a much smaller little rinky dink outfit, but they were offering more money to them. And they said, okay, well, which one? And they were agonizing over it. And they finally said, okay, there's more money. We'll go with Avco. So they called up Katzenberg to tell him. In about 5 minutes, they hung up the phone and said, okay, yes, we're doing it at Paramount. So he was really good at talking them into it. Fortunately for them, because, so then I had, my agent Arnie had a woman that just had come in, very recently had come into his office as another agent. And her name is Beth Voicu. And she had worked with Howard. And so she looked at me, and looked at who is the client list here. And I met her and we all got along really well. And so she called Howard up and says, Howard, I got your Ted Stryker. And Howard said, well, bring him in. So she took me over there and I guess she'd sent a picture over and they looked at it and they said, yeah, okay. Like Jerry, I think, said something about, was he instantly the one? You look at the picture, say, Robert Hayes, don't know who it is. Okay, he's our Thursday at 10 o'clock. Okay. So that's all it was, all that, And so I go in there and we got along really well and they liked me. And then I read for them and they really liked it. And then I got to screen test with Julie, which was so great for me. And we had really good chemistry. And they said they liked my spit take. I did the scene in the hospital bed. I can't remember what she said. She said something, and I'm drinking a glass of water. And she says something, and I did the spit take. And they liked the spit take. So, but they also liked that the approach to it, which I really liked, being a serious kind of a thing. And you don't always get to do that because you have directors that push you to be more, you know, broader, more slapsticky and louder. And it's really great to play it more seriously and let the humor just let the audience laugh. You don't laugh for them. You let them laugh.
That's and, true. And that's why they worked.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, we did it. And then they came over and they sit backstage when we were shooting an Angie or we were rehearsing or doing the camera blocking, getting ready to shoot it. And so I went back behind the set, back to the psych in the back, you know, against the back wall.
Yeah.
And we were just standing behind that. And they said, okay, you're the one. So the three of them and me, and we're standing there and just kind of jumping like little idiots, like little kids. You're the one. Yeah. Oh, wow. How cool. And then we start kind of just goofing off and say, okay, we'll see you. Well, then we'll see you later. We'll see you tomorrow or whatever. And I said, great. And I felt like $1 million. That was a feature film. And it was my first one. And it was like, wow, how cool. And these guys are great. And so, wow, this is terrific. And the script made me, there was something on every single page when I read it that made me laugh. I read it on a plane going back to Minneapolis. And there was something on every single page that made me laugh out loud. So as they're walking away, Jim said, Abrams told me later that he said to him, you know, we've cast him. And so we should watch this show that he's in, this Angie show. And so they watched it. And of course, it's a sitcom. And it's that broad kind of thing that it's not what they were looking for, really. Totally different style of acting. You got a live audience you got to play to, so it's bigger and louder for them. And then you got the, you know, however many millions you got out through that little camera lens, so you got to play it differently for that. So it's a bastardized version. Plus, you got all the lights. Instead of having it lit for one scene, you got to have it lit for walking through the whole thing. And so they watched it and they went, oh God, what have we done? and then we got on the set and started doing it. And they were so happy that it was, you know, we kind of got it and they were happy with it. And Beth Voicu, she used to come on the set because she was so proud of having gotten me got me in there. So she came on the set and she said that they would run up to her and say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Which was fun. It made me feel good.
That's cool. Yeah, you and Julie had great chemistry and Leslie Nielsen. And then how soon after that came out did they say, hey, we're thinking about doing a sequel?
Well, they didn't. They didn't want to. They didn't want to have anything to do with it because they thought it was a one-joke thing and they'd done it.
Yeah.
So Howard said, we want to do, you know, Paramount wants to do a sequel. So they got,
Ken Finkelman. Is that what you're thinking of?
Ken. Yeah. Yes. Canadian guy. And they wanted to go with the same kind of, sort of the same little trick, same device of saying that we got the writer and director, just like with The Boys. So they wanted to get someone that would write it and direct it. So I came in on it. Ken came in on it. And then he asked me if I'd come in and work with him on it. So I would come and meet with him over there. And he was very funny. And one day he came in so exasperated and he was a little bit late in his office over there, a little cubicle that we would work in, over at Paramount. And he came in just exasperated, wiped out. And he set his briefcase down and he says, finally, I know what it's like to make a film in Hollywood. I said, really? He said, yeah. Making the deal is like getting laid. Making the film is like trying to push her out of your apartment. I thought, oh my God. I thought, perfect. That's perfect. Because, you know, you got to deal with, you want to make the film, you want to act, you want to direct, you want to do the stuff that you're doing. And you have these guys coming down there from the, you know, the suits will come down and they'll start saying, hey, well, where's this? Why is this? I had one guy, an old guy who's the exec producer on a different movie I did, a TV movie. And he's standing there watching us. He comes down on the set just to check it out and see how the things are going. He's standing there watching it and he said, why is no one talking? And you've got these moments. You've got to play moments. Sometimes the most important part of the film are these moments.
Yeah.
I'm not paying for silence. I'm paying for words. And we said, oh. And so then we did the scene and it was just like, blah, 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 blah. He said, yeah, that's more like it. And then he left. He said, great. Okay, now let's shoot it the right way. So once we got that little shithead out of there, we got to shoot it the right way. And that's, you know, dealing with those guys is just,
I'm sure,
makes you want to rip your hair out. But and then you've got the ones that are really creative, you know, that really are producers that know what they're doing, you know, and those guys are worth the weight in gold. And Howard was great. Howard was wonderful. We just, everybody loved him. He was, he knew what it was that the boys wanted to do. And he would leave us to do what we were doing, but he was there all the time. But he was there helping us to make sure that it was getting done the way that we wanted it to get done. And he, I can't say enough about him, him or the boys. I mean, they're just the greatest experience. It's just incredible. And when I did Starman, that was the other incredible experience, even though it was only one season, but it was amazing. And Angie was, because that was my first show, and Donna and I, we're still real close.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
She was so fun to work with. But after a while, you want to get out of the soundstage. You want to get out where you can breathe. You know, it's like claustrophobic in there. So as it goes on and on and on for years and years, you could just see people blowing their brains out.
So Robert, what did you think of the sequel? Like after it was all done, you saw it.
Well, there were things about it that I thought were very funny. There were things about it that if the boys, for instance, if the boys had done it, it would have been done just ever so slightly differently. And I think there were certain things they have, to me, they've got the best sense of comedy and of timing of anyone that I've ever known. And Ken was very funny and he had a real good sense of it. He had has a Canadian sense of it, which is a little bit different. And sometimes it works perfectly. And other times it's just a little different sensibility than, you know, there was like a pullback, the little lady, well, I could go on forever, but I don't want to bore you to death. And as the camera pulls back from me, I said, well, I could go on forever, but I don't want to bore you to death. And I think, right when I say, but I don't want to bore you to death, boom, that's when you should see her.
Yeah.
That's the punch.
Yeah, yeah.
But as they had it, as the way they shot it, it was, well, I could go on forever. And halfway through it, there we are. And I'm sitting next to the skeleton in the clothes. And, I'm talking the rest of my stuff. I can bore you to death. So that was just a little off to me. You know, but there was a lot about it that was very, very funny and very good.
I loved it. I've watched that a bunch of times.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I got a letter from somebody and it was one of only maybe two I've ever gotten, but someone in Florida, I think it was. And they said, oh, I loved Airplane 2. That's my favorite. And it winds up that they saw Airplane 2 first before they saw Airplane 1. And so it's just like the boy said, it's a one note kind of the joke of it, you know? And they had done it. So, most people have seen Airplane 1 first and most people like it the best. But when you compare the two, Airplane 1 is just, you know, just here and there. It's got its reasons why it's a little better.
Yeah. And that's why I do. I don't know if when I was talking to Fran and I was emailing back and forth with her. So this podcast that I do with my buddy is about movie sequels. And I think sometimes they don't get a fair shake because somebody will, like you just mentioned, like they'll look at Airplane 1 and they'll be like, well, sure, obviously the first one's better, but I think it's, you got to look at them as like standalone films and man,
well, that's the hard thing. Yeah. If you can do that, it's great because the people would be able to enjoy a lot of movies if they just give it a chance to, you know, to give yourself a chance to be able to enjoy it. Try to just relax and don't worry so much about comparing it to other stuff. Just let it be. And if you let it be, it was a funny movie. It was a lot funnier than a lot of the comedies that are made.
Oh, definitely.
That, you know, just it was a lot better than a lot of other comedies that are made. But you're comparing it against what in some circles was considered the funniest movie ever made. And in others, a lot of circles, it's in the top five. And, you know, in a whole bunch, it's in the top 10.
Oh, yeah.
But they did, you know, every time I see a poll, I wonder, you know, and they say, this is the sixth funniest movie, or this is the fifth funniest movie, whatever. And I wonder, well, what poll is that? Did they sit around with their family and their relatives and some neighbors come by and they say, well, what do you think about this? Well, I think this one was. I think I liked something about Mary. Well, I liked, you know, this one here where they a lot of fart jokes, or I liked, you know, Porky's or whatever. And you think, okay, that's how they did their poll.
Yeah.
But then ABC and People Magazine got together and they did a poll of the funniest movie of all time, the funniest comedy, the best Christmas show, what's the best drama, what's the best movie, what's the best musical, what's the, you know, all of this. And they sent out questionnaires in the industry, ABC did, to people all through the industry, actors, writers, producers, directors. And then People sent out a poll in their magazine to all the subscribers. So that's all over the world. And then they collated everything, put it all together, and then they made a special that was on ABC. And they had Julie and me come very on the QT. And it was down in Venice, I think, or in Santa Monica, at a hotel right down the beach. And we went up there and they filmed this thing and they said, don't tell anybody about this because we want to keep it a secret until the show comes on. But then the show came on, I think a Monday night, and it was the ABC special of the movie poll, a whole big deal. And they would show the top five in every category. And then they said, and the winner, the number one best show is in each category. And in comedy, Airplane was number one. And it was like, wow, okay, that's a really good expansive poll.
Yeah. So,
and we were number one. So that's my favorite poll.
Of course. So, you know, it's funny that we're talking about it today. Yesterday was the 37 years ago yesterday that Airplane 2 came out.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Because just this past August is when we were shooting, 39 years ago, we were shooting Airplane 1.
Oh, wow.
And this coming July is when, July 2nd, I think, is when they had the big release. Before that, in June, I think they released it in Toronto and Buffalo, of all places. You know, it's like, that's what you do, I guess. But they had just an initial release just to test it or something. And then July 2nd, they had the full big release. And that's when it was released across country, and it just broke the box office records in almost every theater it played in.
Wow.
And I remember going to the Westwood. I think it was at the Westwood, in Westwood, or the Village. It was one of those two. And I remember I was sitting up in the back with my girlfriend, Terry, and Tom Perry was there with a friend of his, and who was one of the VPs at Paramount. And so the four of us sat up in the very back row, and a couple came in there were about five of them. And it was, you could tell it was the man and wife, and then the sister of one of them, and then their kids. So the sister was the aunt to the kids, and they were probably 40-ish. And the kids were in, you know, little kids, anywhere from 10 to 15 or whatever. And as they walked in, the sister-in-law did a double take at me because Angie was on at the time.
Yeah.
And then she quickly caught herself and then sat down. The thing comes on, and their very first credit, it says, starring And the taxi drives up on the curb and says, Robert Hayes. And she whipped around and looked at me and I smiled at her. And then as we're going through the scene in the airport and I catch up to Elaine, I wanted to be the way it was. Do you remember? She says, I remember everything. I remember how we run along the beach and how I used to sit on your face and wriggle. And the guy was right in front of me. And this is how long it was. She said, and how I used to sit in your face and wriggle. And there was beat. He, and he whipped to his wife and said, did she just say what I think she said? And I was about falling out of the seat. You couldn't even hear everything because of all the laughter. You'd have to come back and see it again because, you know, you missed a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so they cut it. They wanted to cut it that way. It was really, really, really cool.
So then after Airplane 2, pretty much every year you have a movie come out, Trenchcoat, Touched, Utility, Scandalous. And then one thing I know you sounded pretty excited before was Starman, the TV series.
Yeah. I had read for the role for the movie, but I wasn't a big enough name back then.
Yeah.
And so Jeff Bridges got it. And when I had a deal with Columbia, TriStar, for TV development and feature film development. And we never came up with a film that I liked. And anything I could suggest to them, they think, everything they get brought to me, it was like, So that we just paid that deal off. And then that was, you know, over with. But the TV deal, everything they come up with was also, it just didn't quite gel. And finally, Steve, the guy that was the VP over there that would call me, he was a great guy. And he would call me up and he'd say, I got it. Show for you. I said, yeah, what is it? And he would tell me. And I said, I don't know. That doesn't sound that right. Didn't quite, you know, maybe it was what he was telling me. I don't know, but it just, and he was a very funny guy, but, it just didn't seem to gel. So finally he called me one day and I had one day left on the, contract. And he called up and said, I got it. And I said, what? He said, I got the show for you. I said, great. What is it? And he said, well, no, I'm not going to tell you. I want you to come in and meet, which was very smart of him. And so I went in and met with Mike Gray and John Mason, who were the guys that had developed it. And they pitched it to me. And it was Starman, but it was a TV series and it takes place 13 years after the film. And when at the end of the film, he leaves Jenny, he says, I've given you a baby. She says, I can't have a baby because they, you know, she'd had the operation or whatever. And he says, I know, but I've given you a baby and it will be a boy. And that was the last, you know, the end of the film. So now that little boy is born and now he's 13 years old, but they're separated. She left him with her brother and sister and took off to lead the government guys away from her, Fox and his, you know, team of guys. He signals the signal for me to come back from whatever planet I'm on. So I come back and of course now I'm me. Well, I thought, I don't want to play Jeff Bridges. Jesus, how many, all it is comparisons. And I thought, you know, he's a terrific and it's like, God, man, how do you, so they said, well, he's going to be taking over a different body and all this. And so anyway, we finally did it and it wound up being so much fun. And I love Mike and John and Mike directed a bunch of the shows. And then we had other guys come in and directed that were so great. And it was such a family, the whole crew, everything. I mean, it was, we all got along so wonderfully. And then I had one of those press tours where you're lined up and you're doing you're sitting in a chair and you got a guy come up and hand him the video, the cassette.
Yeah.
And they'd put it in and then they'd sit down in the chair and interview and they'd get out. The next guy would come up and sit down and, you know, from all over the country. And then you'd sit in a room with all the newspaper reporters. And there were about 13 or 14, 15, something like that across from me. And I'm on the other side of it. And they all were really great. They were asking fun questions. And we were just having a lot of fun. And this one woman directly across from me, right in the middle of the group, sat there with her arms folded and a real sour look on her face the whole time, just staring at me. And I thought, boy, this is fun. And then finally it was her turn, and she said, "So, how do you like playing Jeff Bridges?" And everybody they all went, "Ooh, how rude." Yeah. I mean, that was a snotty and rude thing, and everyone went. And I kind of looked at her and I said, "Well, the guy is an alien, and you know, but even he knows that after 13 years, Jeff Bridges' body had smelled pretty bad. So he took mine." And the whole room, except for her, the entire room fell apart laughing. And she just went, and just snortled even worse. She was just so, and it got into all kinds of, like, Chicago papers, the LA Times, the New York Times. That line got into all the papers.
That's great.
Except for hers.
Maybe she was related to that meteorology professor.
Who was the? Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Yeah! Probably. Yeah. It was the same. Yeah, boy, that was his sister.
That is such a great line. That's awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, that turned out to be just incredibly special, and it only went one season. They told Bob Urich. Remember Bob Urich?
No.
Vegas. He did Vegas and
All
those different shows. Yeah. Well, Bob told me, they didn't come and tell me, but Bob told me that the ABC execs had told him one time, "Yeah, the biggest mistake we made last season was not renewing Airplane. I mean, Airplane, not renewing Starman."
Oh man.
And if they had renewed it, I could almost guarantee it would have gone for 4 years, at least 4 years, and we would have had it all syndicated and everything. It would have been worth quite a lot of money. I was a profit participant, which is like an owner having ownership on it. That I gave up residuals just to be able to have that, and that would have been worth a lot of money to me. It would have been really, really great, a real game changer. But it only went to one season, so but it's out on DVD and. You know, rarely you'll see it on TV, but boy, I'll tell you, it was so special.
That's cool.
And it's even though it's dated, you can tell, you know, it was done in the 80s, in the mid late 80s, like 86, 87. And it's dated, the look of it, the clothes, you know, hair, but the humanity of it and the relationships are still valid. They're still so good that I think there's really a good feeling in the show. So it even stands up once you get past the how dated, you know, we didn't have computer generated stuff back then. And it was all just making special effects with holding a little light with a rheostat, the little ball in my hand that would glow. I had wires going down my sleeve, down my pant leg, and they turned the rheostat up, and that was 110. So that sucker got hot. I mean, it burned my hand a couple of times, blistered me a few times. And I said, you know what? I said, there's got to be a way you can make this with a flashlight battery and a little, you know, 1.5 volt batteries, you know, and then have a little battery pack on my belt. And I could just have my hand down at my side and I can turn the little rheostat up. So you guys don't have to be putting lines all through me and I won't have to burn my hand. So they did it. Our prop guy was so wonderful and he created the whole thing and it worked perfectly, absolutely perfectly, as good or better than the whole big 110 volt, 120 volt thing. So it was rough, you know, it was early on, very primitive by today's standards, but the humanity of the show still holds up. And so I think it's, you know, something I'm real proud of. So I've always tried to have fun, no matter what I do. I always try to have a good time because you're on the world, you know, the earth too short to agonize and be miserable and be angry at everybody and everything. It's like, and some people have to do that. They can't get there to where they need to be as an actor unless they do that. And I get it. I mean, that's the kind of person they are. That's their makeup. But for me, it's miserable.
Yeah.
It's awful. And I do a lot of most of the stuff that I've done is the kind of stuff that is fun for the audience. And so if you have fun on the set, it, you know, as long as you keep everything under control and do your work, and don't get lazy and just have goof off all the time, but instead you have fun, but you do your work, then it shows through, you know? So, and there are times when you've got to get real serious. You got to say, hey, not now, guys. You've got to be serious about this. But that's just doing your work. But the rest, you know, you just have a great time. I have a lot of guys, actors, actresses, and crew that have, and producers too, that have come to me, you know, years later, they'll come up to me and say, hey, gosh, man, I worked on that show. You were so great. And that was my first show I ever did. You were so great to me. It made me feel so comfortable. And that makes me feel wonderful.
I bet. Two things I wanted to talk to you about. Because obviously I love The Airplane, but another one of the movies you were in that we watch a lot, and my wife, we were just talking about it too, was Homeward Bound.
Last night it was on.
Oh, really?
I saw it and I clicked on and saw it like the last half or maybe a little over half of it. Yeah, I haven't seen it for a while. And it was, and I emailed Benj, who plays Peter, the oldest.
Oh, cool.
And I emailed him and said, hey, Benj, it's on. And he goes back and said, yep. And he knows when it's scheduled. He knows who's releasing. He is one of the top guys in the business right now for making movie trailers.
That's the
biz that he has. Yeah. And he's writing and trying to get into directing also, but he's having a lot of practice with all the trailers, cutting it together and seeing what angles work best and what, you know, what cuts from what. And so it's really good. He's such a great guy. He's a great kid. I haven't kept in touch with the other kids, but with Benj, it's really, really been fun. And now he's 40 or 40, something like that. And his wife, Amy, they're wonderful, wonderful folks. So it's great. You know, when you meet people and you get to work with them in this business, and then you keep in touch. And a lot of times you don't see each other till you work together again. Or if you do these charity golf things. It used to be we'd do charity tennis tournaments, and now they're charity golf tournaments that we do. And then you see people once a year, or maybe if you're doing a bunch of the tournaments, you see them 2, 3, 4 times a year. And so it's great fun. People in the biz have a certain kind of language and a certain kind of a wavelength they're on. So you kind of get it. Something that you can shorthand, say, talk about something that you get and you're laughing about it. And somebody outside the business wouldn't get it. They don't maybe know exactly what it is you're talking about.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's really, you know, it's like the old joke about the guys in prison. You know, and he's brand new in prison. And the guy says, number 13, everyone laughs. And he says, what was that? And he hears somebody say, hey, number 28. And they all laugh their butts off. And he says, what are they doing? He says, we've told jokes so many times, you got them numbered now. So instead of having to tell the joke, we just tell the number and everyone gets, they know it. And so then he says, can I try one? And he says, sure. He says, number 7. And it's dead. And he says, what happened? And he says, some people just know how to tell a joke. So
that's the
deal.
So you did the two Homeward Bounds, but one thing that was really cool is growing up, I know they're around nowadays, but you know, cartoons are so big in a lot of kids' lives, sitting there Saturday morning cartoons. And I never knew that until I looked at this and then I watched a couple of the episodes. I found them online that you're like, who's Robert Downey Jr.? You're the original Tony Stark and Iron Man. That's pretty cool.
Actually, John Vernon did Iron Man, the animation, before I did.
Oh, what year was that on?
I told him that I found those DVDs, and I said, if you want, I'll give them to you, because we had done something together. I can't remember what. And his daughter and I had done something together. Kate and I had done something together. And so I told John, I said, yeah, if you want these. He said, oh, I'd love it. And then we never saw each other after that, you know, just so long until you get back to seeing each other. And then he passed away, and now they're gone anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I did early on. So, you know, it's funny because people say, yeah, you're the real Iron Man, not Robert Downey Jr. And I think that's very funny because it's an animation. Yeah. But it was great fun doing that. And, and shoot, what's his name? The creator, Stan Lee. Yeah. Went up to Stan's office and got to meet Stan and hang out with him. And then he gave me a cell from one of the animations of Iron Man, and he signed it to me. And it was just...
Were you a comic book fan before it?
Well, yeah. I mean, Superman was my guy.
Yeah.
Superman was my hero. But I loved all of them, you know, that was the DC, but then, you know, I mean, Batman and all the Marvel universe. And I mean, all of those things were great. You loved all of them, but, I didn't know Iron Man as well as I did after I started getting into it. It was so fun. It was just so fun. And,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Robert, this has been so awesome. And thanks so much to you for taking the time. And I bugged Fran so many times, and it's really cool that she really put me in touch with you, because you never know.
Oh, that's
great. How people are going
to. Well, I had a great time. Now, where are you located?
I'm in New Jersey. About probably like 40 minutes outside of New York City. So,
were you near Elizabeth?
No, I'm not near Elizabeth. I'm more of like the western part now. Me and my wife bought a house out here, but we're from like around like Edison, South Plainfield area. So not too far from Elizabeth.
Well, I'm touched, which it went through so many different names. It was it was some sunny day and on the boardwalk, and they finally wound up with touched, which I thought, what idiot came up with that? Jesus. It sounds like, you know, it's like, yeah, really touched in the head, you know, but we filmed that on the boardwalk there, not Atlantic City, but what's the other one? Smaller one than Atlantic City.
Wildwood.
Yeah. Down in the Wildwood.
Oh, no way.
That was another name for a while. It was called Wildwoods for a while. That's
right. Oh, yeah.
That was one of the names. But that was great. Oh, man, I love that. That was really, really neat being down there. And it was at the end of, what is it, Labor Day? Is that the last one, the last big hurrah before the vacation? So it was Labor Day. We got to have all the stuff that was going on. And I think I don't know if they were down there just the people doing that and we filmed it, or if they hired them to do it. I think they maybe just caught them because it was such a low-budget film.
Yeah.
But they had a marimba band. We followed them around a bit and got that. And then we had the, you know, the carnival where you have the hammer, you hit the hammer and it rings the bell. I learned how to do that. And I was swinging that thing and ringing the bell. See how many times in a row I can do it. And I think I did it 85 times in a row.
Wow.
Something like that. And then I had to stop because we had to go film. But it was so fun. And then after that weekend, then it's just deserted. Everyone's gone.
Oh, I know.
Labor Day holiday's over with, and everyone's gone, and the kids are back to school, and everything's. And so then we had it deserted, which is what we also needed. And then if we needed a crowd, we just brought in a bunch of extras and, you know, and make a little crowd around there and shoot some stuff. But it was really great because then we didn't have all the gawkers around saying, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, growing a tail or whatever. So, cause you know, the guys in New Jersey are, you know, it's like they're so quiet and discreet, you know,
I know. Sure.
Hey, what are you doing there? You know? So it was fun. It was great. Ned Beatty. Oh, geez.
Oh, he's awesome.
What an actor. And Kathleen Beller is just so cute. Just this little thing that you just want to scoop up, and she's just so darling. And she was so good. She was wonderful. And all the, you know, we had some really terrific actors in that show. It was a fun experience. But
that's awesome.
And I worked out with a guy that was Tom something. He'd been a heavyweight fighter. He was about 6'4", 6'5", and he was a heavyweight, but he was real trim, and he was handsome, like a male model. He was really a handsome guy. And he had the fastest knockout on the heavyweight records. It was within 10 seconds of the first round. God. And he was from Joliet outside Chicago. And the funny thing is, when he talked like that. And he sounded like Muhammad Ali when he talked. But here is this white, Irish-looking guy, you know, that and he was my trainer. I hired him as my trainer, and he just, boy, he put me through the paces. He'd have me with, I'd have my gym shorts and a t-shirt, and over that I'd have sweatpants and a sweatshirt and your socks and your tennis shoes and everything. And over that, a sauna suit over that. And he'd have me lifting weights, but I wanted to trim down. I was 178 when I did airplane, but I wanted to get thinner and more gaunt for this. And so he trimmed me down. I was like 168. I was like 10 pounds lighter, which is really gaunt for me. 168, 169. And he had me lifting weights, but instead of lifting a bar with a whole bunch of weights on it, it was just the bar alone with the little collars that hold the weights on, you know? And then he'd sometimes put on just a little 5 pounder or a 10 pounder at the end of it. And that was it. But he would have me do curls, but I do 100. And then he'd have me do them overhead, but I do 100 of those. So instead of a lot of heavy weight to bulk up muscle, he wanted me doing lots of reps of lightweight to trim everything down. And then he had me skipping rope. And I was, by that time, he said, I want you to wear the heaviest boots you have. So I had some mountaineering boots and big old leather mountaineering boots. And I lived down at the bottom of Nichols Canyon up in the Hollywood Hills. And he had me running uphill, skipping rope backwards.
Jeez.
So I was doing that. And then I'd be skipping rope. And I actually got fairly good skipping rope. Probably couldn't do it anymore. But and I was in really good shape, energy wise, everything going into that. And boy, that was that one was a real jewel to me. I wish that would come out, that people could see that more, because that was one that I was proud of.
Yeah, the people that I talked to, there was always like one movie that maybe didn't get like that wide release, or a lot of people weren't able to see it. So I'm sure.
Yeah, the guy that did it, the producer, really didn't really, kind of was young at it, didn't know what he was doing really well. He got a lot of investors, his parents, and from Virginia, I think. And I think the parents or friends of the parents were in tobacco. And so he would get money from them. And they were like, you know, okay, but no more. And we did it for a really low budget. And I had points on it and everything. But then he just kind of screwed it up. He didn't have the connections. He didn't have all the things to get a decent release and get a promo campaign, you know. And so it just kind of died. And it's too bad. I wanted to try to buy it at one point so I could own it. And then I could just try to, you know, at least get a release on it.
Yeah.
But that never came about. But yeah, it's something that I had a copy of everything, just about everything that I'd ever done. And I had some fans that had copies of things that they'd either made off the TV, things that you couldn't find anywhere.
Yeah.
That they'd recorded off TV. And so they were pretty cruddy. You know, it's recorded on a VCR or a tape camera.
Yeah.
So that's losing quality. And then they transfer it, and that loses another generation. And so that was before the digital age. And then by the time they make copies, they put it on DVD, but it's a DVD that's gone through a couple of generations of tape. But at least I had something, you know. So,
oh yeah.
So yeah, and maybe someday I'll try to kind of piece a lot of that back together. I want to get all that stuff together. You know, you have something to give your kid and say, yeah, I worked one time.
Yeah, I did this.
This is your old man.
Yeah.
You know?
Robert, this has been awesome, man.
Well, thank you, Doug. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate it.
Man, wasn't Robert awesome? He was so cool. He really enjoyed himself. And just the way he just made me feel good at the end. He was really kind. He really enjoyed talking to me. And that's why I love doing this. That's why me and Jamie started this, because you know, we have the opportunity to talk to all these people. So yeah, so now your job is to watch Airplane 2, the sequel. Like I said, Prime Video, Crackle, all free. Watch it. Don't forget to review, rate, share our podcast. Find Follow us on all social media at Sequels Only. And if you're first time checking us out, or you've checked us out before, always you can go to sequelsonly.com. We have all the movies we reviewed, all the people we interviewed, little clips from things they're in on the page. So again, sequelsonly.com. Stay safe. Good night.